This is the Taylor Report, and as promised, we're going to speak to Keith Bollender, freelance journalist and an author of three outstanding books about Cuba. Keith, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Phil. It's good to be here under the new reality.
The new reality, yeah. We're about to go into an extraordinary moment in the U.S., and of course, it's going to have impact on other countries, Canada, but a country that you are focused on as a writer, Cuba. And well, I guess I want to know your thoughts. First of all, are Cubans following this election closely? And do you know what they expect to come out of it? They've been having a lot of trouble with Trump.
Yeah, the Cuban government certainly is, and the average Cuban, to the best of his ability, is following what's happening. And you're absolutely right. You know, this election is of extreme importance to Cuba because like between Biden and Trump, there is such a stark difference, not only for the American voting public, but for Cuba. It really is going to have an incredible impact for the next 4 years in Cuba, depending who wins tomorrow's election. You know, we know what Trump has done to Cuba in the last year and a half. During his campaign 4 years ago, he was all in favor of Obama's normalization program. He wanted to build hotels in Cuba. He was all supportive of bringing Cuba out of the cold into American normal practice. But the last year and a half, he has just been so hostile against Cuba. He has done so many things. And if you can give me just a quick minute, I can list a few of them. He's restricted flights from the United States to Cuba. Now there's only American flights coming into Havana. And again, Cuba is under lockdown under COVID. But this happened well before COVID hit. He shut down American tourism from coming to Cuba. He stopped U.S. cruise lines from coming into Cuba. He prohibited U.S. hotel management of Cuban properties. He ended U.S. business interests speculation into Cuban business opportunities. He's really restricted remittances, really, in the last week or so. He's made it harder for remittances to be sent from the United States into Cuba. And as a result, Western Union, who has been operating in Cuba for years, is closing down all their offices. He's been criticizing Cuban doctors in their efforts to fight COVID internationally. He's restricted academic interchanges, and he's made it difficult for Cubans to get more visas to the United States at the U.S. Embassy. So he's done this incredible amount of harm in the middle of a pandemic when the Cuban people are suffering more than ever economically. He's just making things worse and worse. So 4 more years of Trump would be very, very disastrous for the Cuban people.
Yeah. Well, that raises, he has Florida, of course, he lives in Florida, and we all understand that when the Democrats and the Republicans get ready for an election, Florida always turns out to be a place where they concentrate their energies. And sometimes they will compete with each other how they're going to take care of Cuba. And tell us about the Miami phenomenon, who are there? I know that some of your books have focused on the criminal aspects of some of the most prominent Cubans in Miami.
Yeah, Florida remains the key between American-Cuban relations. And Trump's return to hostility is based on the assumption that the Cuban-American electorate will vote for Trump based on his hostile acts against Cuba in the last year and a half. And that's from the hard right Cuban-American community, most noticeably Republican congressmen like Marco Rubio, who have convinced Trump that, hey, if you want to win Florida, and Florida is so important for the Electoral College situation, that you have to go back to really punish Cuba, and that will turn out the Cuban-American vote for you. And it may not. I mean, the first generation Cuban-Americans are definitely going to vote for Trump. They're strong Republicans. But a lot of polls have shown that the new generation of Cuban-Americans want to engage with Cuba. They want the embargo to be over. They want to go back and forth to Cuba, and they want to do business with Cuba. But the complication is there's been some reports, some polls coming out really recently saying a majority of Cuban Americans support Trump. They don't like his hostile policies against Cuba, but they support him. So it's really complicated. So Florida, as normal, is going to be a key state to watch during the election. It really is, could be the decider. If Trump wins Florida, then it's going to be a lot easier for him to gain the number of electoral college votes for him to be reelected. If he doesn't win Florida, the chances are really slim.
Yeah. Oh my gosh. We're speaking to Keith Bollender. This is the Taylor Report. And Keith has his last book out about Cuba was Manufacturing the Enemy, and about the US media and the role they play. I guess I should ask you, do you know what Biden's strategy on the Cuba question is? And what does he say to people of Florida?
Yeah, it's that's the other side of the situation. Both Biden and Harris have come out publicly in speeches in Florida and elsewhere saying that they would, if elected, if Biden was elected, they would reinstitute Obama's strategy of normalization and that they would turn back all of Trump's hostility. So he has made it very clear that, you know, he was vice president when Obama did start the normalization process in 2014. So he's made it very, very clear that he supported that policy and that if elected, he would return to Obama's policy of normalizing relations. So then American tourists could come back to Cuba. There would be increase in flights. The American businessmen would be encouraged to go to Cuba. So you're looking at a completely stark choice.
It's a different
for Cuba. 4 years of continued punishment or 4 years of return to the movement towards normalcy. Now there's a difference between what Biden can do as a president, because Trump's return to hostility was all done through presidential directive. He didn't have to have Congress support it or not. Same with Biden, regardless who wins Congress, whether the Republicans still maintain Congress or not, if Biden's elected president, he can reverse all of Trump's hostilities by presidential directive.
You know, Americans need to be thinking of what kind of government they've got. You know, this is so much like a monarchy. It's like decoupling from the American Congress and just acting out, doing what they want.
Well, and this is the ping pong game Cuba has been involved with, you know, Obama's move towards normalization was a huge game changer in 2014. There was such optimism. There was definite economic benefits for the people of Cuba.
Returned, and I mean, people forget that was dramatic.
It was a game changer, and the Cuban government supported it fully. And as I said, there was tremendous economic benefits. And there was actually, during the 2016 election, there was a lot of Cubans thinking, well, even if Trump gets elected, he won't disable Obama's normalization policy, because he's a businessman, because he wants, you know, to do business in Cuba, and he knows it's good for American business to open up Cuba. What they didn't realize was the influence of the Cuban-American hard right community to this day. And they got a hold of Trump and said, you want to be president still? You got to do this in Florida against the Cubans.
Yeah. Well, there's also, Miami has such a reputation, in Miami, the city. I don't really know Florida that well, the demographics, but there's other folks there who are problematic in my memory, and I'd like you to comment on it. We now have Venezuelan expats who do not like Maduro. And I assume that they make a common cause with the Cuban expatriate community. And then you throw in Panamanians. There are a lot of other interesting people there.
Yeah, very, very much so. With Venezuela, you know, the first generation exiles that left under Chavez and now Maduro, you know, they were similar to the first generation Cubans who left Cuba after the revolution, the same economic class, the loss of political power, you know, even the racial makeup of these exiles. So they definitely have common cause between the Cuban American hard right and the Venezuelan hard right. So I don't think the Venezuelan community is as well organized or as politically powerful as the Cuban American community, because the Cuban American community has had decades to establish themselves. But definitely I would think the Venezuelan community in a majority will vote for Trump. So again, you have this dynamic of you know, the Latin perspective voting Democratic is not necessarily true in Florida's case, because you have these exile communities who are in general more conservative and more inclined to vote for the Republican policies than the Democrats.
Yeah. What you're describing in terms of Trump's posture, which is extremely hostile, I mean, that list you ran down, there are additional nasty acts on his part. It raises a question. It almost reminds me of the darkest moments that Cuba went through with the fall of the former Soviet Union. And we saw, and I think you witnessed and know all intimately what happened there. They were pushed to the edge, but survived. How are they coping now? I mean, the European Union, is it true that they're not following entirely the sanctions? To what extent do they go along, and how much do they resist what is coming from Washington?
Yeah, it's a good question, because there's a lot of Cubans who think they're going through another special period, which was how they described the fall of the Soviet Union and the loss of 35% of their economy overnight, and people really going hungry in the streets, and you know, the real ending of a lot of what the strengths of Cuban society were. What's happening now, the return of American hostility on its own is damaging enough, but now the Cubans are dealing with COVID. And so where before they adjusted after the fall of the Soviet Union to open up to the rest of the world, to introduce tourism, to connect with Europe and Canada and South America, they can't do that now. There's no tourists coming to Cuba. There's a few coming from England to some of the resorts on the little islands on the north side of Cuba, but nothing. So not only are they dealing with the return of American hostility and all the economic damage that's doing, they have the harder problem under COVID, because they're so dependent on tourism. There's no tourism coming. There are shortages of everything, of food, of gas, of energy. And there's no other avenue until the country reopens, whether dealing with COVID or whether there's a vaccine or whatever. So I think they may be facing even a worse situation than what they did when the Soviet Union collapsed.
Yeah. The only, I guess, difference is that everybody in the neighborhood is suffering the same way, right? I mean, all these countries, this COVID thing has really been a blow to the solar plexus.
Absolutely. The Cubans can look at their neighbors in Central America and the Caribbean and at least take some comfort that they're better off. The number of cases in Cuba are really quite low compared to what's happening in Central America and other neighboring countries. But still, it's, you know, small consolation when the Cuban economy is just suffering so bad. And then you have, you know, Trump and the American administration attacking Cuba for the internationalism that Cuba has shown by sending medical teams around the world to help fight COVID. Now there is an economic component, and the Cuban government does receive funds, but they're doing it where no other country has, and countries where the Cuban medical staff has been to, Italy and other countries, have said this has been so important.
They have the capacity. And in that sense, they're advanced, really. They're designed for crisis, because the imperialists gave them a crisis. They say, you know, it's kind of like they say the fire born or at home in the fire.
Yeah, they've certainly had decades of experience of dealing with shortages and crises, and and using their human resources to their best ability.
And they have morale. I mean, they're not shocked. They have a leadership that is, again, the whole country experienced it. So they have a confidence in each other. One of the things I notice in these other, many of the other countries, particularly in South America, there is no confidence by the poor in their leaders. So whereas in Cuba, okay, I suffered and you suffered, but in these most of South America, the ruling classes don't suffer. So when they tell the poor, well, you're going to have to suffer. Yeah, well, who are you to tell me?
Well, and yeah, exactly. Because in a lot of countries, and I know specifically in a number of Central American countries, the government is basically doing nothing to help overcome the crisis, where the Cuban government, and they're so limited resources, they're trying their best to maintain their social programs, including their education and their health. The biggest challenge right now is food security. But again, the Cuban government has had experience in dealing with that, and they're doing their best. So you're absolutely right when you say the Cuban people, I believe, really still have confidence in the Cuban government doing the best they can, knowing the limitations that the Americans are trying to put on them and the COVID has, where other governments that have much better resources aren't doing nearly as much for the average person.
Yeah. We're speaking to Keith Bolander, author of several excellent books about Cuba, particularly exposing the plots from Washington to assassinate Cubans and to, of course, the long-term view of always wishing to overturn them. Keith, I'm going to ask you about the Cuban doctor's story. Relation to Brazil. Brazil has a leader who is, you know, loosely speaking, a fascist. And he put on a show of making Trump happy and telling the Cuban doctors to leave. But that has been reversed, hasn't it? And also the Cuban doctors have been nominated for a Nobel Prize. What do you think of that?
Oh, I think it's great. The view from Washington is a little different. There's all sorts of noise coming out of Washington that they don't deserve it, which is just typical American bias. But Brazil is definitely an interesting case. There were thousands of Cuban doctors in Brazil even before the COVID crisis hit, and then they increased, and they were doing amazing work. And then for political reasons, the president of Brazil, who's a buddy of Trump, kicked the Cubans out. And the backlash was pretty immediate, where a lot of communities in Brazil were saying, well, now what are we supposed to do? We have no, you know, medical facilities here. We have nobody to take care of us. So there is discussions and a movement to bring the Cuban doctors back. And again, it's funny because that could be tied in to tomorrow's election too. Let's say Biden gets elected and his attitude is, to reinstate the normalization policy. That's part of it. I mean, I can't imagine him attacking the Cuban medical staffs that are working internationally the same way Trump has. So you may see countries like Brazil, you know, saying, well, yeah, we'd love to have the Cuban doctors back now because there's a new man in the White House. So, you know, it's just tomorrow, the election is just going to be so important for Cuba on so many levels where you might not think this has an effect, but it will.
Well, while we're on that matter, I have to ask you, Argentina has had a change. They've elected again a relatively progressive administration. The previous group were tending towards Lima and this U.S.-led thing to get rid of the government of Venezuela. Argentina's relations like with Cuba?
They're stable. They're nothing. You know, they're not as close as through other countries. Like you look what happened just recently in Bolivia. Now that the coup has been righted and you have a center-left government back in power in Bolivia, the new president has already said, you know, we are going to reestablish relations, normal relations with Cuba and Venezuela, And that will mean, you know, economic interchanges, Cuban doctors going there. So, yeah, it really, like everything, politics makes strange bedfellows. But when you have Trump having such influence on certain countries, hopefully that will change with the election as well. So I think I take great heart from the Bolivia situation, and you may be seeing a swing back to more progressive governments in Latin America over the next few years.
It does appear to be a trend, doesn't it? I mean, although I've asked the question, I don't know if anybody knows the answer, but the president, the Evo Morales, said that the reason they removed him was that he was going to nationalize lithium. He was going to protect it from foreign private outfits. And I don't know what happened on that question, but if I was a Bolivian, I'd be asking, and what about lithium? But I think his party says they're going to follow his plan, right?
Yeah, I've heard that exact same thing. Yeah, and I mean, it wouldn't be the first time that a government has been overthrown by trying to nationalize their natural resources. So yeah, I've actually heard that could be the case where they are going to proceed with that. It will be interesting to see.
You know, from Cuban history, actually, in so many ways, the Cuban Revolution is a litmus for the rest of South America, because putting your hands on American private property is the way to get killed. And I recall that Americans love Fidel. They really thought he was a wonderful guy until he said, we're going to nationalize the King Ranch, among others. And I think it was United Fruit, wasn't it?
Yes.
And when he said that, he went from nice guy to monster overnight.
Well, that's what happens when you think you own the house, and where the actual owners say, no, actually, you don't own the house. So the Americans said, wait a minute, we own Cuba. How can these ragtag rebels tell us something different? And how dare they? And that's been the basis of American regime change strategy since 1959.
Yes. Yes, it's private property is sacred. Of course, the president of Mexico, who nationalized Standard Oil in Mexico, can't say his name, I bet you can, but Fidel knew him. It was on his ranch that Fidel was practicing, and he was practically overthrown by the Roosevelt administration for nationalizing the oil of Mexico.
The difference being, Mexico is a much larger country with much more influence, where Cuba was this tiny little country that was causing no problem with the United States. They were nice and friendly, and they let the Americans run things and the mafia run things, and the American tourists came down. And then Fidel said, wait a minute, we're going to change the dynamics of this relationship. And the Americans said, yeah, you can do it, but we're going to punish you up until 2020. So Trump is a reflection of this American policy of regime change and never forgiving Cuba for having the temerity to establish real national sovereignty, which is what the revolution was all about.
Yeah. It's inescapable that Cuba is sort of its fate to have challenged and to sustain the challenge. And I think we have to say to Mr. President Biden, if he has the idea that by putting an arm around their shoulder that he'll convince them to change their ways, Cuba's going to remain under the type of leadership Fidel created.
Well, it's funny, because Obama's strategy was, you know, 50 years of giving Cuba the stick hasn't changed their minds. So let's give them a carrot and let's bring down American know-how and capitalism and culture and music and all the good things about America, and that the Cubans will finally wake up and say, oh my God, what have we been doing? Let's get rid of our government and bring in the Americans. What happened was, the Americans were coming down to Cuba and they were finding way more about the Cubans than the Cubans were finding about the Americans, because the Cubans are extremely knowledgeable about American society, culture, history, relationships, everything. So it was quite remarkable that the Americans were coming down and saying, hey, you know, this isn't as bad as what we've been portraying it for the last 50 years. They certainly have their problems. I may not want to live under this system, but it's their system. And a lot of the Cubans want to maintain it without being told by another country how they have to run their own government. So a large part of the reflection of Americans coming back from Cuba under Obama's normalization was getting into the mainstream politics, and the hard right Cuban Americans were really getting concerned because they were losing the message, because individual Americans could go down and see for themselves the reality of Cuba and not have to rely on the media or the anti-revolutionary politicians to tell them about Cuban society and life. So that was, to me, was the main, one of the main benefits of Obama's normalization. But, you know, with no hesitation, Obama made it very clear his strategy was still regime change, but he was going to do it by letting the Cubans see how wonderful America culture was and not being punished all the time. Where Trump said, no, I'm going back to punishing them because eventually they're going to get fed up and say, we're going to get rid of our government and bring the Americans in. That's never going to happen. It's never going to happen. But it's interesting how Obama's strategy, he made it very clear, we want to extend a friendship to Cuba because we think this is the way to affect regime change. And the Cubans said, bring it on, come on down. It's a lot. I'd rather have American friendship than American animosity. And it was beneficial way more for the Cubans than it was for the Americans, but it did benefit both.
It's going to be really interesting, Keith. You painted a picture here that we're going to have to come back and analyze, because we probably will have a new president. It would appear, although I only a fool would say for sure. By the way, the American electoral process, from a Cuban point of view and from point of view of people around the world, is somewhat exposed the myth or the notion of an American democracy, because it's so odd the way the elections are conducted and strange, you know, electoral college. I mean, you'd have to sit down for some hours with Cuban students to noodle that out. Well, what's that all about?
Yeah, I don't think anyone can figure it out. And also, you're seeing the basic political differences and the hostilities that voter suppression, gerrymandering, you know, tossing out ballots. Tuesday's election is not going to be the end. It's going to be the start of something that could last for days, if not weeks. And we still,
how much they dislike each other, which also must amuse the Cubans.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, the other complication we haven't even talked about, what happens if Biden gets elected, but Congress is still in Republican hands, or if Trump gets elected and the Democrats win Congress, what does that mean for Cuba? Because the embargo is still in the hands of Congress. So if the Democrats win the president and the Congress, then you might have a chance in a few years to have Congress look at the embargo, which is still the key to the relationship between Cuba and the United States.
I'm glad you raised that point, and it would be a good one to close on. I want you to explain, and this is Keith Bolander we're speaking to, a freelance writer and author of many important books. Keith, we have to remind everyone that the U.S. talks about sanctions, and it talks about applying laws against Cuba. None of those have any standing in international law, right?
None. And it's one of the frustrating aspects of the...
In the name of an illegal act of your own, you starve them?
But it also has an effect, extraterritoriality effects with other... countries, in, for example, Canada. There's been many Canadian companies who have wanted to do business in Cuba that have been prohibited because they are a subsidiary of an American head office, and they have to follow American laws, even though they're legally constituted under the laws of Canada. So it's not just people talk about the blockade or the embargo between the United States and Cuba. It's far, far more reaching than that. And the Americans use their influence. Obviously, they control the international monetary system, so they use their influence to to strong arm other countries not to do business with Cuba.
And all countries around the earth have told them that at the United Nations, right? Down to, what is it, U.S. plus one or none?
Yeah, it's usually, you know, Israel and the important Pacific Islands of the Solomons voting for the embargo, and the rest of the world votes against it. But the Americans have always said it doesn't matter. It's not an international matter. The blockade, the embargo between the United States and Cuba is strictly a national policy issue, which gives you insight onto how the Americans think about Cuba, that they're just a wayward state that is going to come back into the American fold, and they have no right for national sovereignty on their own.
And what they think of other countries' opinions, which is nothing.
Nothing. Yeah, it does not matter. It's strictly, the Americans see it strictly as a symbolic and has no effect whatsoever on their policy against Cuba.
Boy, it's great talking to you, Keith Bollender, author of Manufacturing the Enemy and Voices from the Other Side. Look forward to more books from you, Keith. And hey, how about it? Maybe we plan in a couple of weeks to come back and talk about, okay, now what?
It may take a couple of weeks for this all to settle down.
Canada has a new president.
If they count all the votes, or they're going to not count the votes or whatever. Yeah, I would love to come back and hopefully say, yes, Joe Biden has won. And now we can look at what that really does mean in the next 4 years of the relationship between the United States and Cuba for the sake of the Cuban people.
Well, thanks, Keith Bollender. This is the Taylor Report, CIUT 89.5 FM. We'll be back in a moment.